everybody, and welcome to a very special free preview of this month's What a Cartoon Movie episode all about The Great Mouse Detective. I am one of your hosts for this one, the drunk on Rodent's Choice Brandy, Bob Mackey. It's disgusting. And who is here with me today?
Henry Flangerhanger Gilbert. Oh, hello.
I thought it was Flabbersham. Anyhow, as with every month, at the end of the month, we give you a free extended preview of our What a Cartoon Movie episodes. And this one is a great one because we're talking about the 1986 overlooked classic, The Great Mouse Detective. We're recording this right after we recorded the whole thing. And it's roughly, I'm guessing, 4-ish hours long.
Close to it, yes. I'd say, yes.
It's one of our shorter episodes because the movie is only 74 minutes long. I believe the Animatrix was like 40 minutes longer, but we still find plenty of things to talk about, including the very fascinating history of The Great Mouse Detective at a very interesting time for Disney. You're going to hear part of that as part of this free preview.
Yes, and you know, our What a Cartoon Movie now is the fourth podcast we do each month on the What a Cartoon feed, and we give you guys this extended preview. But if you want to hear the full thing, you need to become a subscriber for $10 a month at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And when you sign up there, you'll not only get to hear the full version of The Great Mouse Detective, but all of our previous What a Cartoon Movie podcasts.
Yes, I believe we are up to maybe 14 or 15 now. Soon, yeah. I'll lose count, but each one is about 3 to 4 hours long. Mm-hmm. And it is just like an episode of What a Cartoon. We go over the history of the thing we're talking about and then do a walkthrough of that thing with clips and trivia and our own thoughts. If you like what we do on What a Cartoon, there's so much of it you haven't heard that is part of the $10 tier at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
Yes, films like Aladdin, A Goofy Movie, Nightmare Before Christmas, Toy Story, Cowboy Bebop the Movie, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Beavis and Butthead Do America, and so many more. You can only hear those in full if you are a Patreon subscriber at $10 a month. $5 a month, folks, if you move up to 10, those will all unlock in your RSS feed. And if you start at 10, you get access to an RSS feed at all times of all of those podcasts.
And if I could make a few recommendations, I think some good companion pieces to this podcast would be our Aladdin podcast, mm-hmm, and our Secret of NIMH podcast. Yes. Both are which directly related to people that worked on this movie and also the time in which this movie was made. So those are good companion pieces to The Great Mouse Detective, and they're only available at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Thank you so much for listening to this little intro. Now we'll let you hear our extended preview of the history of The Great Mouse Detective. We are now in the year 1982, the perfect year because Henry and I were born.
Yep,
it's the best year to be born in because you get to experience all of the best years before 9/11.
Yes,
and yeah. You're a child.
Your childhood is the same as mine. You have all of the correct signposts.
All the best nostalgia.
Yep.
So by 1982, The Rescuers was far enough away that Disney artists Ron Clements and Pete Young pitched it to the very short-lived Disney CEO Ron Miller, who approved the project. So as you said, I didn't know that based on until this conversation that he was Walt Disney's son-in-law, but he had been with the company long time, though. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it was them trying to keep it in the family, too, was the reasons for it. But, like, I think history reflects that he was not as good at business as the guys after him.
No, I think his term there was 4 years, not incredibly successful. So, Clements was particularly interested in Sherlock Holmes and got hired by Disney based on a 15-minute short film he made about the character. So, that was the way he got into Disney.
That's really cool.
I didn't see if that film was online, but I bet someone can scrounge it up. But, yeah.
It's got to be out there. Unless it was like a live action thing, I would think, man, in 15 minutes, that can't be, I guess it could be a student like animated film, but that's a long student animated film to make.
Very, very long, but yeah. I would like to see that. So the pitch for The Great Mouse Detective was developed during the production of The Black Cauldron, because even during production, they're like, okay, we need something else for these guys to work on if this just falls apart completely. So come up with a separate pitch and maybe a separate production we can all like offload everyone onto if this Black Cauldron thing collapses completely. And that's why they were sort of coming out so close together. in 85, 86, we have Black Cauldron and Great Mouse Detective.
Yeah, I mean, well, Cauldron got delayed so many times and, like, recut and heavily edited that it probably came out way later than they originally planned, which is why they were so close together, too.
And so this movie was basically greenlit while Ron Miller was there. So this was something he gave the thumbs up to. And I think the one impact he had on the movie was Olivia was going to be a grown woman and potential love interest for Basil. And we see a version of that at the end of the movie, like a lovely young woman coming in with a problem. But Ron Miller was like, make it a little kid so there's more heart to the movie. So, you know, Basil, it softens him a bit. He's not just horny for this other adult mouse.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a... I think it was a smart move in this film. Sometimes I complain that it looks like who shoved a kid in there just because this is a kid's thing. The story's better without kids. But Olivia is a fun kid who they don't. She's kidnapped for half the movie anyway, so she's barely holding back the adult smoking and drinking fun of this movie.
So many drunks, so many people getting wasted and smoking cigarettes and cigars and pipes and everything.
But by
it's a real cancerous movie.
But by removing the love interest from it, that does make this a gayer movie.
It really does. It really gays it up.
Yeah, this is why in future movies, you know, people joke in the media criticism sphere of just like, well, they only added this girl to this story because you'd think this character was gay if there wasn't a girl he was interested in. And this is an example of how that happens. By Basil not showing interest in one woman the entire film.
But showing a lot of interest in one man.
I'd say a couple men. I think he's you know, he likes this Dawson quite a lot.
That's true. He's like, you're going to live with me now.
Yeah, and so... that is how these fan theories and ships begin if there's no evidence of heterosexuality.
So some other things changed from the book. There was going to be a seedy stool pigeon character that is from the book as an informant for Basil, but he was removed just to make Basil go out and get all the information himself.
That makes sense. Plus, you know, on a stricter budget, the fewer lead characters you have, the cheaper your animation gets as well.
And also, any scene that wasn't central to the story was cut. So there was going to be a scene to establish the tone that, like, basically all of the chimes of Big Ben are going off. And as each of them goes off, one of the lamplights is extinguished along a London street. Like, so anything really to set up tone, they cut completely because very slim budget for this movie. But you can notice in the movie, there's very few establishing shots. And when there are, they're over very quickly.
Yeah, you're right. I never considered that, but man, that Big Ben shot would have been so cool. Like,
yeah, I could see that happening before we go into the toy shop in the beginning of the movie, just like show a few scenes of London, but we're just zooming into that toy shop immediately at the beginning of this movie.
And especially for a little kid, you know, who's not familiar with England, you kind of need Big Ben to be set up as a key place because it'll be the setting later in the film. You know, 4-year-olds don't necessarily know what Big Ben is.
So Bernie Madison and John Musker were assigned as the original directors. And of course, we know from the Aladdin podcast, John Musker and Ron Clements are the directors of Aladdin. And they directed Little Mermaid and Hercules and Treasure Planet and Moana.
Yeah, they are now the nine. They're the two old men of Disney of their time. I think they really get overlooked a whole lot in modern animation history, you know, because they're not, I think, you know, compare them to, say, Brad Bird. They're not these, like, in-your-face auteurs, and they're two guys who kind of split credit, so.
Yeah, and they're company men, basically, who just never left. Like, Brad Bird, like, went off on his own, like the brave individualist he was, to make his own stories.
Yeah.
And then he worked for Disney.
But Clements and Musker, they've overseen, like, some of the greatest successes in animation history, and great films, too, like they're as directors, their portfolio is amazing. And I think it's I like learning more and more about these guys, too.
So, yes. So Bernie Madison, John Musker, original directors. Dave Michener was assigned as an additional director. And Ron Miller was the original producer until he was replaced by good old Michael Eisner and Frank Wells, who were brought in from Paramount and Warner Brothers, respectively, to bring new life to the Walt Disney Company in 1984.
Yeah, that's that's a whole podcast on its own.
It really is. But fascinating time.
Yeah.
Eisner, not knowing anything about animation, I believe. We may have told the story on Aladdin, but I believe there's a story of him, like, like walking in to look at footage of the Black Cauldron, and he was asking for a different angle on something as if they shot coverage of an animated movie. It's like, let's get the reverse shot on this guy. Like, no, we didn't draw that, sir.
That's so funny. If I may make a little Eisner aside here, my husband and I fell down a YouTube rabbit hole of Eisner clips and funny things.
Oh, goody.
Also, if you guys liked our chat with Scott Gardner about his Eisner Hello clip package, he did an extended by 20 seconds collection of hellos that everybody should watch on the Podcast The Ride YouTube channel. But anyway, we were watching Michael Eisner like interviews. He did like his own interview show for like one season after he quit Disney, like the Michael Eisner Show.
I have so many stories to tell.
One of the best I saw, this was an interview, like a sit down panel he did with George Lucas right after Lucas sold to Disney. And Lucas tells the story of right before Eisner got hired, Lucas and Eisner are talking about this. They both agree that this is what happened. Lucas is asked, like, by Disney, we'll buy Lucasfilm, ooh, and you run Disney. And Lucas was like, I might want to do that. You know, I want to focus on my stuff. But, you know, there's this guy at Paramount who worked on all my Indiana Jones movies.
Okay.
So
that's how he got a reference, I guess, from George Lucas.
Eisner is there to, like, he's nodding along, seemingly agreeing that that is what happened. So perhaps if George Lucas hadn't suggested Michael Eisner, he would have never even been hired by Disney.
I really have to read that immense book, Disney War. It's like 608 pages. It's all about, like, Michael Eisner and his tenure at Disney. It sounds fascinating. I know, like, I can see it in the background of Lindsay Ellis's YouTube videos. Yeah. It's just like, it looks so big and interesting.
I'm going to bring her up later on this, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, she's a great resource on some of the stuff we'll be talking about later. But yes, so Michael Eisner, Frank Wells came in, and this is not part of this timeline, but Frank Wells would later die in the 90s in a helicopter accident. And because Jeffrey Katzenberg was not promoted to his position by Eisner, he left the company and stole a bunch of ideas and basically started DreamWorks.
Another moment that changed animation history right there.
So Bernie Madison was originally producer and director, but he dropped out of directing to focus on producing this very streamlined project, just taking over all the producer duties. But he still has some directing credit on the movie.
So many goddamn directors on this. Like, four. Jesus Christ.
It was super. I believe they had 18 months to do all the animation. So when Bernie Madison dropped out, Ron Clements was brought in as an additional director. So just so many directors. So there were 3 years of pre-production work on the film, but at this point, the team needed to repitch the idea to these new executives in order to continue making the movie. And again, Eisner was new to animation, and he was confused by things like storyboards. Like, I'm sure when he read scripts, it's just like, drop the script off on my desk. But it's like, when he wants to see, like, the plot of a movie, it's a bunch of nerds pointing to little squares in a room and showing him. He's just like, this is a comic book. What are you talking about? We're making a movie here.
We're making a movie. Yeah, this is a big moment in Waking Sleeping Beauty. They're talking about the pains of the animation department in the mid-80s and these presentations. They talk about how, like, they were, you know, very precious about their amazing drawings they would do for storyboards. And when stuff would get cut, they would be pissed off. And there's some very funny, like, you know, camcorder footage of animators talking to each other, just like, oh, what's this giant stack of drawings? Just going in the garbage. It's nothing. Oh, isn't this a great drawing from Oliver and Company? Rips it in half on screen. It's gone. No more drawings.
There's a great parody of that sort of thing in the Ren and Stimpy episode, Stimpy's Cartoon Show, when Ren, as John Kay, comes in and tears apart all of Stimpy's storyboards, leaving him in tears.
Look, sometimes if you draw something, you need to draw it again, and there should be storyboard revisions, but the cruelty of people who don't draw telling you, like, your drawing sucks, draw it again, that I could see that causing a tense situation to get worse in the Disney feature animation division.
And also another big problem for Eisner was he didn't approve this movie or greenlight it. Mm-hmm. It had to be repitched to him. But he and Katzenberg thought, like, this is too old and corny. It's not contemporary. You can see Oliver and Company was 87. That movie is like 80s animated movie, the movie. It's just like Billy Joel and Bette Midler and Cheech Marin and pop songs and 80s New York. It is such a contemporary movie of that time. You can see the direction they wanted to go. And this was not it.
It feels like such a response to this movie, almost like them saying, like, you fucking dorks in your old 1800 shit. Like, here's what's cool. Like, this, I would bet Eisner's son approved of that idea of the Billy Joel movie.
Oh, one of the ideas I'm sure came from his son was Michael Eisner. So we have the bar scene where Let Me Be Good to You plays, mm-hmm. that kind of song that has nothing to do with the movie, but just a fun set piece. Michael Eisner never liked it, and he wanted Michael Jackson to perform that, or perform a song in that scene.
Boy, they are lucky that didn't happen.
I mean, it would have been a major tonal clash to begin with, and just as hilarious as seeing like Vanilla Ice in the second Turtles movie in retrospect. But
and now it wouldn't even it would be censored from Disney Plus, I would think.
Oh God, it'd be just removed from history. But so he didn't like that. So previously there was another song in that scene. We'll talk more about it later. But that "Let Me Be Good to You" was their compromise for a more contemporary sounding song that still is a little old timey. Mm-hmm. Another idea Eisner had was having Madonna do the score for the movie. very odd ideas from an outsider. And I will say that it's not uncommon. And Henry and I have lived through it where an executive comes in, knows nothing about your job, but still thinks he has better ideas than you. Mm-hmm. In some ways, having an outsider perspective is good. In other ways, it's totally infuriating and you just want to pull your hair out. It's not a good time to be alive when you're in that situation.
especially when you're on a giant project like an animated film and you have a new boss show up who you all know wouldn't have approved this in the first place, hates your film. And so when he's giving you, you know, artistic tips or edits, you're like, but you don't want this to exist anyway. So what's your judgment on this matter? Like, and the reason it matters is because he's your boss. Other than that, it doesn't. But I mean, those calls like that, like the Madonna thing again, it's just like fucking, it's Billy Joel all over again. This is how you end up with that.
At least they're able to start with Billy Joel, not like insert Madonna halfway through production.
Though, I mean, not that Madonna wasn't big in like, let's say they were making this choice in like 84. She was, you know, a pop star in 84, but she wasn't huge. Like, she wasn't Madonna.
Yeah, I'd say like 88, 89, 90.
Yeah, I mean, the Madonna really, who does a bunch of songs in Dick Tracy, that's a star. Like, that's a megastar who can give a lot of kids confusing pants feelings in their childhood.
I believe she could fall in love with me from that one video. I believe Open Your Heart.
Oh, yeah.
Where the little boy goes to the peep show.
That's a creepy scene.
It really is. Yeah, but it meant a lot to me when I was six or whatever. Like, oh, Madonna could be my girlfriend? Show me how. Anyways, I will tell you, everyone out there, that there's a great two-part feature called How Basil Saved Disney Feature Animation by Jim Corcus, the animation historian.
Ooh.
It is on his archived website on archive.org. I pull a lot of that information from those two articles. He did a ton of work on, you know, just figuring out everything to do with this movie. So
that's awesome, because I would think in the rare times Clement and Musker can do interviews, they are either promoting a current movie or are going to be asked about one of the Renaissance films, not a modest success that happened before the Renaissance.
And I really wish that it's not a commentary, but I don't even know if like before the 2000s, any Disney feature has a commentary on it. I'm sure
Pixar
some do.
Would do commentaries. Yeah. I remember that, but yeah, I can't recall a commentary on any of the Disney DVDs.
I would love to hear that.
These guys are not getting any younger.
No. We need all of their thoughts recorded like we do every day. So this is a quote from that Jim Corcus feature about how Eisner wanted to change the song. So Henry Mancini, who is the composer of this movie, had written a parody of a Victorian British music hall type of tune titled Are You the One Who Loves Me? It was already in rough animation with the song recorded by Shani Wells.
Oh, fuck. It got to rough animation.
They had to basically like refit it, this new song. So it was recorded by Shani Wallace, familiar for her work in the musical Oliver. So Wallace also supplies the voice for the Lady Mouse at the very end of the film that we see. So she exists in the film in some small ways still.
That's good, at least.
But Katzenberg didn't like it because he felt the kids in the audience wouldn't like it because it was not contemporary enough. So
that's always his note. Like, I imagine a child and that child's bored. Me.
I just don't understand. I mean, I get it, but it's just like making something contemporary for now also makes it date way faster. Like,
yeah, Oliver, like fucking Shrek.
Yes. and Oliver and Company, which is better than Shrek, but still it is now a timepiece. And so Henry Mancini went off to write another song, a more contemporary song for the bar scene, and also that was rejected. So they brought in Grammy Award-winning singer Melissa Manchester.
Ooh.
And I had no idea who she was until this research.
Oh, wow, man. Well, I am gayer than you, Bob, so I know
it's very true.
She
but she was chosen chosen mostly because in 1979 she was nominated for Oscars for the themes for the movies Ice Castles and The Promise, two movies no one remembers. And yeah. I have a bit of the Ice Castles theme.
Now, this I haven't heard.
It's very like 70s contemporary, which does not fit in with a 1986 movie. But her song in the movie sounds like it's from that era. Let's listen to Ice Castles, the theme. It's Through the Eyes of Love from the motion picture Ice Castle. So Melissa Manchester, yeah, I had no idea who she was. So what do you know her from, Henry?
Well, first off, I have a new favorite song. And that's I love any kind of like throaty, womeny power ballad, which is that also adds to more of the camp gayness of this film, too. But Melissa Manchester, actually, I knew her because she was a guest on The Muppet Show.
And oh,
one of my
of
favorite
course.
Episodes of The Muppet Show as a kid. She sang, "Don't cry out loud, keep it inside, learn how to hide your feelings."
So is that a song from like 1923, like a lot of those covers were in The Muppet Show?
I think it was an original for her. Okay. Not that she wrote it. She's a chanteuse, not
they,
a song
they never writer. Played those kind of songs on the radio when I was growing up, even like on Light FM.
Yeah, so that's why that song was so special to me, seeing it on The Muppet Show, because I wasn't hearing these kind of like, you know, gay ballads on these things, and her episode was just a lot of fun, and yeah, like her songs, like in this, are, you know, old timey but still feel modern for the 70s, which then puts it her song in this in a really weird position, I think. But I love the song in this movie.
So they basically just refit that song into the existing scene and made it work.
Yeah, that's, I wondered what, you know, now that you say that, that whole scene is making a lot more sense to me. They're like, oh, some of these poses are off, or they just like flash between moves
and they cut away a lot too.
Yeah, which you wouldn't normally do in a long dance sequence like that, so makes a lot more sense now.
So all these changes are happening. Eisner and Katzenberg don't know what to do with this movie. It wasn't their project, but all these people are still working on it. So Eisner asked for Katzenberg's opinion, and he said basically, quote, "We have 175 people and we are paying them every day to come into work. We are going to pay them whether they make the movie or whether they don't make the movie. So I guess we ought to make the movie." So their thought was like, this thing was already moving when we got here. These people are getting paid. If we threw the movie away, it'd be a waste of our time and money. Yeah. Let the nerds make their little mouse movie and then we'll make our movie next. Like, I think that's basically it.
That boy, that framing of it is such a Katzenberg-y thing too, that it almost feels like what he said before that is, now obviously I'd lay all these people off right now and we start from scratch, but since we have 175 people that we're not going to fire, then just have them make something instead of not making something.
It's funny that the existence of Katzenberg makes Eisner look like the best executive ever, even though he's awful in his own ways.
Yeah, and well, the Imagineering doc, as well as Waking Sleeping Beauty, makes a very strong argument that without Frank Wells to temper his ideas and guide him, Eisner is like half the executive he would be.
And I think Frank Wells was sort of like the guy that would calm the, or put out the fires between Eisner and Katzenberg.
Yeah, that's usually, and also Roy E. Disney, like he's also there causing scraps.
Yeah, he's on the featurette of that's on the Blu-ray. It's like an of the time featurette. All the actors are still alive. I think it was probably just sent out to the news stations. Like, you can play a clip of this on the news about how Vincent Price voiced a mouse or something in this movie.
Yeah, that's on Disney Plus too, which they didn't take very good care of that. It's like straight off of VHS.
Yeah, it's in bad shape.
Yeah, but I mean, Roy Disney, like, he was making a lot of calls in the animation department then too, as is a big point of Waking Sleeping Beauty. But also he was the guy you're going to put on camera on those features then, because it's like, well, yeah, his last name's Disney.
And he looks a lot like Walt Disney.
He looks a lot like Walt. I wonder how hard he worked to look like Walt as well.
Growing that little pencil-thin mustache.
Yeah. But and in Waking Sleeping Beauty, too, they also mentioned that a lot of the tension during Great Mouse Detective 2 was that they kicked them out of their classic Walt studio where they'd worked, and said shoved him into like a warehouse in Glendale.
It was actually Pasadena.
Oh, Pasadena.
It doesn't matter because it's not on the lot. Yes, so they were like, well, what are we doing? Are we just going to like die here?
I mean, I totally think like, well, this is what they do before they shut down a company. So I guess our days are numbered.
You're all moving to a new office. Well, some of you are. Some of you won't be. So the good news after this pitch meeting, the movie was approved. The bad news, the movie would have less than half the budget of The Black Cauldron. Mm. And a summer 86 release date instead of a Christmas 87 release date. So like, make your movie, but make it fast and cheap. Yeah. And then we get to make our movie next, nerds.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad it got made, but I feel bad it had its budget slashed so much compared to just because of Black Cauldron costing so much. And that, I think that, you know, when they've got Don Bluth breathing down their necks, like, you don't want to look cheaper. You shouldn't. But they were just thinking of money there. And I mean, Black Cauldron being the failure that it was, if you expect failure from your next one, then you at least want to minimize it by slashing costs. So I get that. But this could have used a little more money, but I think they do really good with what they have.
They do way more than they have to. We'll talk more about that later. So yes, animation began in fall of 84. So they had around 18 months to make it. It was a 90-minute movie that was basically sliced down into 74 minutes. So even from the beginning, it was going to be a cheaper movie, but they made it even cheaper and more slimmed down than the original plan.
And I mean, a lot of their thinking then too, when it came to budget, was like, well, it cost them zero, or not zero, but they can just re-release a classic film in theaters every year and make a shitload of money off that. Is there even a need to have new films when you can just go like a decade straight, just re-release Pinocchio, Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, and over again until you cycle through a decade? And then you're like, well, it's a new bunch of kids. Let's re-release these again.
Eisner, the 1985 release of 101 Dalmatians, the re-release of the classic movie, made a record $33 million for the company, wow. A record for a re-release. And that's what made Eisner think, like, why are we still making these new ones? Do we need to? We can just put the old ones in theaters again. And I wish they still did that. Like, they stopped doing that when we were really little kids.
Yeah, I mean, once, it's funny, they made so much money off that right as our childhoods were beginning. And then when home video comes out, at first they resisted and they're like, oh, wait, no, we can do the moratorium thing even better and make even more money.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I feel like by the late 80s, when the VCR was becoming not like a luxury item, but just a commonplace item in the middle class person's house, that's when those re-releases ended for sure.
Yeah. Well, you're seeing this now in a hot topic in the revival theater community is how Disney never licenses their films. You can't show them anywhere. They won't give you permission to do it. And now that they have ownership of the Fox films, those aren't getting put into revival theaters either. And
that's a real bummer.
It sucks.
I hate it.
It sucks.
So what Eisner learned from The Black Cauldron is that you can fail, but you shouldn't fail at a high cost. Mm. It also didn't help that the Care Bears movie came out the same year as Black Cauldron and made the same box office amount despite having a sliver of the budget. So I think Care Bears movie was made for $6 million and made like $80 million or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a weird time for animated movies because you would have crappy TV level animation like Care Bears movie. You'd have things like the Transformers movie, a very good looking but very dumb movie. You'd have things like the Heathcliff movie or whatever, which is like, here are three stories Heathcliff will tell his nephews or whatever.
Or the He-Man movie that was also just a bunch of clips like these.
That's where that itchy and scratchy movie 33% new footage joke comes from, because that was the state of animated movies in this time period, like right around the time we were born and very little.
Yeah, the prestige was just going away. And I mean, Disney, I think, opened the door to that a little with how they were cutting costs. But then on top of that, you have a lot more overseas animation and just, you know, companies like the folks making Care Bears who are just like, it's a movie in a theater. Kids can't tell cell count. They don't know this shit.
Oh, yeah. But Care Bears, the movie, $3 million budget, $34 million take, box office take.
And I mean, also, I would do a Black Cauldron podcast long before I do the Care Bears movie podcast.
Oh, yeah. We can't go there. I don't even want to give people the option.
Now, look, do I have slight childhood memories of the Care Bears movie too? Sure, there's some scary stuff in there that is etched in my brain, but I don't remember one cell of the first Care Bears movie. Oh, man, but you said Transformers movie. That one, boy, oh boy, that'll be a 5-hour podcast.
I will gladly watch that. I have no nostalgia for the Transformers, but that movie looks really good.
Oh, yeah.
So you're right. Actually, you're right, Henry. I apologize. It was Glendale. That's where they were moved off the lot into a quote-unquote unsavory warehouse in Glendale to make this movie very cheap.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to skip ahead. I just remember that's a big complaint in Waking Sleeping Beauty. Like, they have the camcorder footage of them just walking around these, like, shitty warehouses. And like mobile home type trailers they're working out of too. And they make a joke about how, like, well, as we were killing time, we decided we would fully reenact Apocalypse Now and film it in here. And so you have camcorder footage of them all acting out scenes from Apocalypse
Now.
Okay,
I got to watch this finally.
It's cute.
We keep bringing it up. I need to watch it. So they also, The Rescuers was the big touchstone. Like, this was our previous Mouse movie. Why do you want to make a new one? They decided to make it as different from that movie as possible. Humans are not an element in the movie. A few humans like in shadows, and then we see the shadows of Watson and Holmes, but there's no... Because I honestly think that the presence of humans and humans on screen speaking in large roles would have you asking too many questions about the world. Like, okay, the mice have their own newspaper. The mice have their own furniture and homes, and they have their own like machinery. And apparently, there's a mouse economy. Like, how can this coexist with humans? If there were humans in the movie, you would ask too many questions.
I have many questions. I am going to pedantically bring up a number of questions on this. But yeah,
where do they print the mouse newspaper, anyways? I want to know.
A scalability. How can gears even be that small just because a mouse makes it?
I don't buy it. I want to buy a mouse toy, though.
But also, these mice all have the respectability of wearing pants, unlike Bob Newhart's mouse around pantsless.
So everything's flopping everywhere. Shame on you, Bob.
I mean, mice don't have large genitals. So.
No.
I've seen some big sacks on a couple of
those get very big because they've got to reproduce fast.
Yes.
Time's a ticking.
Anyway.
Yes. You all learned a scientific fact on this podcast. I want to talk about, I have a big section in the history about the Big Ben part of this movie.
Oh, boy.
A very, very, very short effect shot, but is the first use of a computer-assisted animation in a Disney feature. Not computer animation, but computer-assisted animation. So this was all spearheaded by Mike Peraza. Go back to our Goof Troop episode. He is the creator of Goof Troop and a longtime Disney story guy throughout the 80s and 90s.
Wow.
So that is who basically wanted to make this happen. He was a huge fan of The Castle of Cagliostro, the classic Miyazaki Lupin movie.
Yes. Yeah, that'll be a future movie someday too, but I guess we first need to do a regular Lupin episode, I think. But yes, it's everybody's favorite Lupin film if they've never seen Lupin, and it's also just amazing.
It's the best version of that character.
Yeah. Well, some folks who like the horniness would disagree with you, but I
guess the new Lupin are more based on him, the progressive, the Lupin with heart.
but it ends with a giant battle between the villain Lupin and the girl he has, who's being held captive in a gigantic clock tower, and to know that it was done without CGI really gives a lot of credit to the animators at TMS under Miyazaki at that time.
But, I'm sure he killed several animators with that scene.
and they thanked him for it because he was a genius.
Yes, he deserves to. We deserve his punishment.
Yes.
But so the finale for this movie was originally supposed to take place on the outside of Big Ben with Radigan falling to his demise. But Peraza convinced John Musker to change it so they break through the face of Big Ben first. And the gears would pose an additional threat to Radigan and Basil.
Oh, the scene makes all the difference. Like, it is, if it just cut to the fight on the clock hands, it's not enough time. Like, there's so much more excitement in the chase inside the gears before the fight on the outside.
And it's a fantastic scene. And I believe all the effects like weigh in at less than 2 minutes, the effect shots. But in order to get all these shots and make the thing accurate, Mike Peraza and his wife went to London not only to take location photos from a mouse eye view, but also to go inside Big Ben, lugging heavy video and camera equipment up all of these rickety old Big Ben stairs, and then laying down on the ground to take pictures and take video, and even going into the bell chamber, you can only stay there for less than 15 minutes because it chimes every 15 minutes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they went inside of Big Ben to see like where this scene could take place.
Wowie, man. That is so much extra work that, like, that, especially for when you think of the cheap movie, like, that they put all that work into it, like, it feels like so much thanks needs to be given to Perrazzo that it's just his, like, force of will that got it in the film in the first place.
And this is making the movie more expensive and more, you know, time intensive too. So, like, they could have just skipped this scene entirely. Like, yeah. Like, let's just make the movie cheap and fast. But no, he wanted to put this scene in it because he loved that Miyazaki scene. He also wanted to play around with technology. So here's a quote from Perrazzo on Big Ben. Quote, "We found a lot of things when we visited Big Ben, like what the clock hands are made out of. This helps when you're drawing hands close up. We're going to have shots where the camera will be in very close to the face. Here, the correct detail can make the difference in the believability of the setting. It's such a famous landmark that if you cheat it, I think people will feel cheated. Yeah. If you do a thorough job and get the accuracy when you can, but then have to exaggerate something for artistic license or to make something more dramatic, then you'll at least have a good foundation to draw from." So yeah, it's very, very specific to every part of Big Ben that you see on the screen.
That's great. That's great. I mean, for a film that's been all about scale the whole time, like, it is a great final expression of that to finally show you, like, okay, we've had these mice around human-sized thing the whole time. Now they're going to be inside of a giant clock. Like, it's a great finale moment.
So I'll try to explain how this was all done without being boring or overly technical, because it's not super technical from a modern perspective. Like, we all play 3D games. We've moved around cameras in a 3D space in a video game before. So it's not too different from that. So they worked with WED Imagineering. So they were in charge of
old WED
theme park design and architecture and the machine shop on the Disney Black Lot, which created blueprints for the machinery inside the clock. So they basically created a 3D set inside of a computer, like a 3D modeled set that would operate like a machine.
Okay.
And essentially what they would do was they plotted the scene, like, frame by frame, how the camera would move, and then had printouts of every frame that they would then trace or have a computer trace, rather, to make it look like you were seeing a 3D, like, polygonal object. So essentially, let's say you're playing Quake, and you take off all the textures, just wireframe, and you move your camera from, like, left to right. If you were to take a print out of every frame of that movement, that's essentially what they did.
Mm-hmm. And then you draw over it and add ink and paint, and then put in the mice over it too. Yeah.
And in order to plot out these drawings, he was essentially, like, drawing Basil and Radigan on the TV screen with grease paint. It's like, okay, now move the camera this way, now move it that way, and, like, just plotting out everything. Flittery frame by frame, a 24 frames per second movie.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's essentially how they did it. They didn't computer animate an object and put it in the movie. They computer animated an object and then put the tracings of that object moving in the movie, because they didn't have the technology to do that sort of complicated thing. Like, Tron was the limit of what they could do at this point.
Well, I mean, you look at from Great Mouse Detective to the films that going on, more and more computers getting involved in the production of it. Like, this was a big step, Rescuers Down Under being colored all in a computer. That was a big one. And then, or like, think of Carpet in Aladdin is fully a 3D character living in the world.
I can't think of any 3D shots in Little Mermaid or 3D assisted shots or CGI assisted shots, but I know it's like, you know, the ballroom scene in Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, God, yes.
And then the carpet scene in Aladdin, and then the wildebeest scene in Lion King. Like, always these little subtle effect shots are creeping in as they move closer to being a 3D only movie company.
Sadly. And what I love in those moments, like the Beauty and the Beast one, is that the CGI is moving at a certain frame rate that the animation, like, cell count and specificity of movement has to step up a ton to match it. And, like, in that sequence, James Baxter is famous for, like, drawing the every step of the dance and how just perfect he is. He's one of the, like, best living animators around.
Like, the characters have to occupy the constantly shifting space in a way that's convincing. And I believe Perrazzo said, if you watch the scene, it doesn't quite work completely. Like, Basil and Radigan are kind of floaty a bit. They
just
don't have the weight.
Yeah.
But it still is so impressive that it was all done basically, quote unquote, by hand.
For doing it for the first time, you learn a lot of lessons, and so I forgive, you know, the floatiness of, like, a couple times, like, definitely when Basil stands up the first time as the camera's moving down. You're like, yeah, I guess he's floating a little bit in this space. Yeah,
but they're basically just like it's a game of telephone between a computer and their and their cells, essentially.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Simpsons animated a lot like a decade later, they would use this same kind of thing for like in the Spring Break episode, the camera move on the car or the spaceships chasing after Bart in the Treehouse of
and
Mars.
The big pullout on the Brooklyn Bridge or whatever in Homer versus New York. Yeah, so yeah, this technique would be used in the future because it's just a very easy way to do a lot of math and a lot of calculations of you know, background objects instead of doing it all in your brain.
Mm-hmm. At least, I mean, even then, for like if you have a solid object moving in space, it can help a lot, especially on a television production timeline like The Simpsons was working with.
So what's also impressive is I'm sure they existed, but they were not common. They did not use a mouse for their computers. This is all done on just a keyboard.
They should have used a mouse for the movie.
Perhaps a great mouse they could have used. But yes, all plotted by hand. So for this two-minute scene, the gears were done by Tad Guilo with character animation by Phil Nibelink. And here's a story of how things went horribly wrong with their first attempt. So this is by Phil Nibelink. This quote, he says, quote, Guilo and I were locked in the same room for months, slaving over a hot computer. At one point, we left the computer running overnight because we were in such a production crunch. Some janitor thought he was doing us a favor and closed the door. In the morning, it was like 1,000 degrees in this hot box. The computer had completely self-destructed. Of course, it had forgotten what we had meticulously programmed into it. Fortunately, we had it all on paper, so we had to sit there and type it back in.
Oh.
Like all of the coordinates for the camera movements, the gear movements, they had to type them all back in because the janitor closed the door.
Wow, that's, Jesus Christ. And now just a mouse movement and all that computing is just done on a laptop worse than this.
You can make 3D objects in rooms with just like the basic stuff that comes with Windows now.
Yes, yeah. In high school, I could do that even. So, wow.
So here's a quote from, I believe, Nibelink for how it worked. I gave my own version of this, but here is his words exactly. So we printed the computer animation of the wheels onto special pieces of paper, which were then photocopied onto cells and later colored the traditional way. We tried to color them on the computer, but there was a too great of a difference between the computer result and the result of the film. So it's a very flat colored technical showpiece because it was already too much work to begin with. Mm. So it's all hand painted. Every one of those gears.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, you know, that mention of the Xeroxing thing, there's a few moments in here that feel like the 70s Disney style of Xerox animation that they you know, famously used in the Dalmatians, especially like when paper moves around, the newspaper stuff, that feels more of the Xerox era.
I agree. And the shame about this version of the movie that I watched, and I assume it's the same one in Disney Plus, it is like computer cleaned up.
Yeah.
Where I can see like how the lines were compromised, how it was originally a little rougher or a little dustier, and I want to see that version of the movie. It makes it a little too clean and a little too just like artificial.
Yeah, Disney likes it clean. Yeah. It's simple and clean is the way that they like it.
Yes, that's why they make Kingdom Hearts, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. But yes, so here is what Nibelink said at the time this movie came out about computer animation. It's very funny in retrospect, but he said, quote, it is improbable that computers will ever be able to recreate this kind of personality-oriented character animation that Disney artists have mastered, largely because the animator is essentially the actor who supplies the emotional core with his own timing and imagination. However, the Great Mouse Detective offers evidence of just how helpful a tool computers can be. So he would be proven wrong 10 years later with Toy Story.
Yeah, but Toy Story would come a decade later.
As Fry said, time makes fools of us all.
It's true. It's true. I mean, I would probably say that about a thing that creates writing. Like, it's like, well, this machine can't write an article like a human can. Like, no, in 10 years it will.
We will be the John Henrys of the podcasting game. We'll fight that computer to the death.
That's going
to
be a tough one to automate. That computer, can that computer emulate my specific nostalgia correctly?
Oh, it
probably
might be able
someday,
to.
Someday, I think.
With all of the ways that, like, every social network you use has been mining your brain for information,
you're right.
It's building an artificial Henry right now to replace you.
I shouldn't have answered all those tweets about a thing that scared me as a kid.
Every MySpace quiz you took 15 years ago, it's all part of AI Henry now.
Yeah.